On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For most of human history, we had only words to describe human intelligence: bright, dim, genius, fool. But in the last century, we've had numbers, IQ numbers, as in intelligence quotient. IQ testing made intelligence seem measurable and humans sortable by the numbers. And sort them we have into schools and sterilization and even death camps. These days, our understanding of intelligence has expanded, but we're still taking IQ tests. My guest today says it's a failed idea. Up next on Point, the fascinating history of our long romance with IQ. Joining me now from Santa Barbara, California, Stephen Murdoch. His new book is IQ, A Smart History of a Failed Idea. Stephen Murdoch, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
A failed idea. I know there are many pieces to your assessment of failure here, but what's at the heart of it? What's the core failure you see in IQ and IQ testing?
Well, it's a very good idea, and I realize that my subtitle is A Smart History of a Failed Idea, but really one of the interesting ideas of it is it was a brilliant idea. It was a brilliant idea about 100 years ago. The problem is we haven't moved on. But the fact is, you know, it's better to take a test, an IQ test or some other kind of test, to get into a school or a college or a job. Let's face it, it's far better than nepotism or other forms of hiring people or accepting people, ideas that were used before, well, even today. But the first IQ test that was published was in 1905 by a Frenchman, and he made this leap of testing intelligence. And it was brilliant in the sense that the similar tests that came before were funny sort of Victorian ideas of testing physical ability. There's a guy named Francis Galton in England.
This is Charles Darwin's cousin, you remind
exactly.
us.
Exactly, yeah, and the founder of this supposed science of eugenics, which is an interesting idea of breeding humans, really breeding humans like cattle, which is the basic idea that people came to IQ tests with.
That is to breed humans for positive traits, physically and mentally, intellectually.
Exactly. IQ testers and people interested in intelligence have always been, unfortunately, really into big ideas. And Francis Galton was the first one. And he wanted no less than to alter the human race. He wanted to improve us. And what he really wanted were tests to get people early, you know, in their late teens and early 20s, to find out who the Einsteins were going to be. Before they, of course, they were 50 or so, and they couldn't reproduce.
That's worth dwelling on. He wanted to improve the human race by sort of, I suppose, breeding exemplary specimens in the sort of old thinking of that time. But you couldn't wait to see what they had accomplished in life to judge that. He needed a way to know when people were young and at reproducing age.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, he didn't want to wait for they only had reputation to go on, and reputation is a lag and not a very good test. He wanted a scientific way of getting in, but he had these marvelously wacky Victorian ways of doing it. How quickly could you punch a padded rod? How forcefully could you blow into a tube? And he tested your visual acuity, all on the idea that this would test your neurological efficiency, and that people who are neurologically efficient would be more talented mentally. And then there was this great leap forward by this guy, Alfred Binet, who decided to test thinking, and that's where we've been for the past 100 years. But what's interesting about it is that Galton's ideas, his eugenic ideas, stuck with us, and so we still believe, or a lot of us do, that we have a test that tests an innate singular ability called intelligence, and it's useful to test people on it.
That very much operative in the world today. I mean, people still, of course, test for it, and you hear stories about hedge fund managers swapping IQ tests and IQ scores. People really priding themselves or hiding their IQ number, depending how they look at it. You say that even today, it's a really charged issue, a really emotional issue for people to
right.
talk about IQ. Why?
Well, I think it's for the reason that you just alluded to. During the research for this book over the past 4 or 5 years, I can't tell you the number of people I spoke to who felt badly about their IQs. I mean, really, if you're in the top 10% or 5% or whatever it is, you feel quite chuffed about it. You feel quite pleased about it. But the rest of the people, to some degree, feel like they were underserved by this thing. And I'm happy to tell the listeners that these tests really do not test this innate singular ability called intelligence. but really more knowledge and some sort of abstract problem-solving ability.
Stephen, how widely are IQ tests used today? Are all school children tested or only particular children? Where do IQ tests get applied now?
It's a very, very good question, and really people will be surprised to learn they're just used all over the place. Of course, they are used in schools. Private schools use them at an extremely early age, often at age 3 or 4, to see who should be admitted to their pre-K or kindergarten program. Public schools use them to decide who goes into gifted and talented education classes really at quite early ages as well, often around 9 or 10.
Does that mean they're universally given in public schools, or they only give them to kids who they think may have special needs or special abilities? What is it these days?
Yeah, good question. Universally, yes, but it depends on the jurisdiction and area. Of course, education is decentralized in America, so it's up to the school district. But I would imagine it's the vast majority of school districts that still employ IQ tests in that manner. And, of course, they're used to figure out who has learning disabilities as well. It's probably the most prominent use in education. And so if you've got a high IQ, let's say you've got an IQ of 120, and the average would be 100, and you're a kid and you can't learn to read for some reason, so they're going to use IQ tests in that way, that sort of ability-achievement discrepancy.
And what about in the working world? How widely used for, I don't know, hiring or promoting?
Yeah.
What's the application there?
Yeah, exactly. Used all of the time. One of the most interesting uses in the employment area is by the U.S. military. And, of course, IQ tests are useful when you've got a lot of bodies and minds to figure out and sort, and you're a big institution and you need to know what to do with them. And so the U.S. military gives something called the ASVAB, and they've got heaps and heaps of essentially high school seniors and people around that age who they don't know much about, and so they'll give an IQ test to them to decide to, first of all, screen them. They don't let people in with an IQ of lower than 80, and also to place them in various jobs within the military. One of the interesting things about that is it's actually useful. That's why IQ tests are complicated. The problem with IQ tests is they don't test intelligence, but they're billed as such. But we shouldn't lose in this picture that they can be useful devices when used in an unharmful way.
You say they work more for organizations than for individuals, meaning...
It's very insightful point. Exactly right. There's really, throughout the history of IQ tests, there's a tension between institutions and individuals, with institutions winning out. That's the shame of it. Psychologists used IQ tests in the early part of the 20th century to gain access and power. They sold themselves as a young field who were really on the outskirts of society and academia, and they said to the military, education, law, and various other areas, they said, we can test this innate ability, and we're going to help you become more efficient at a time when the population was booming. And so while that's not true, it did gain access for psychology. Having said that, to go back to the military, these tests can be useful. You just stop talking about them as if they test intelligence. So historically, in times when the military has accepted people who have IQ scores of less than 80, the military has been less efficient. People couldn't read maps as well. They couldn't follow orders as well. So it actually makes sense to in a broad way, if you're a large employer, to screen people with the IQ test.
Take us back to some of that history. It's fascinating. You describe what a span of a few weeks at the opening of America's involvement in World War I, when seven men sitting in rural New Jersey banged out a bunch of questions that would set us off on this hyper-focused IQ testing path.
Yeah, it is. It's unknown and really interesting. And really, those seven men in rural New Jersey in the month of April in 1917 spawned the standardized testing industry in America and really radically changed our culture.
Who were they? What were they up to?
Well, they were psychologists, and they were pitching themselves to the military. And really what they did is codify what IQ tests and the later standardized tests would look like. And they cobbled together test questions that had been bouncing around in various areas, interestingly, on Ellis Island. In the 19-teens, they started testing immigrants as they came from Europe with IQ tests, and they'd send the ones back so they wouldn't taint the gene pool. That's why it goes back to that eugenic idea, who didn't do well. And so these guys who wanted to pitch the Army on the test took test questions from Ellis Island, from schools in France, from schools in America, places and in the workplace, and they wrapped them all together in a nice big bundle and put them together so the Army could process thousands and thousands of men who are trying to enter the military every day to go and fight in the fields of France.
But if you're measuring intelligence, they had questions like, you remind us, the armadillo is A kind of ornamental shrub, B an animal, C a musical instrument, D a dagger. Is that a measure of intelligence, or?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny you should raise that one. I love that question. That's the first IQ test question that I read when I went to the Library of Congress, which is where I did most of this of the research. And I love that question for that reason exactly. I don't see how you can really argue that what is an armadillo that tests an innate ability called intelligence. It's just not possible. So that was one of my first questions, and that question comes from those men in rural New Jersey, by the way. And the second question I had there was, how much did the test change? And that first day, and that first question, I thought, that seems like a wacky question to me. Surely the tests have changed up through today, you know, 90 years later. And the answer to that question is that they haven't changed. They still ask questions like that and other ones that they used in World War One.
The whole notion of intelligence has expanded significantly since that kind of packaging went on, has it not? I mean, isn't there a much bigger sense of what human intelligence means?
Yeah, very good point again. And historically, it's interesting. It was in the early 1980s that there was a sort of blossoming within psychology and outside of psychology, where there were a group of minority but very interesting psychologists who got out from under the thumb of this IQ model, that there's this one singular intelligence that we can test. And I'm thinking of people, of course, like Howard Gardner at Harvard, who coined this idea of multiple intelligences. And there's another fellow like Robert Sternberg at Yale, and there are people who have tested and thought about cognitive processing. So, yeah, we've really moved away, although we haven't moved away in terms of how these tests are applied.
Stephen, if I may, let's begin to take a few listeners' calls here. Amy is calling from Stowe, Massachusetts. Amy, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
All right. What do you think?
So I'm an assessment professional, and so I actually...
What does that mean, Amy? Like an educational tester?
I'm an educational therapist,
okay.
And one of the things I do is I use both IQ tests and achievement tests and other kinds of tests that examine different areas of cognitive or academic functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And your guest said that that tests benefit the organization more than they benefit the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it really depends on how they're used. We're not trying to boil a kid down to a number. I agree with him on that. But what we're really looking at is patterns of strength and weakness. And all of the modern IQ tests really are designed to let you look at an individual's performance on different kinds of tasks. Not saying, oh, now here we've got this is the number that attaches to this individual for the rest of their life. But says, what is the snapshot right now? How does this kid do on this kind of task versus that kind of task?
Right, so, Amy, let me ask you, if you were putting a child into an educational setting, into school, or an adult into a job, would you see IQ testing as useful for the school, the employer, and for the individual?
Well, it can be very useful if it's taken in the proper context. Scores do not by themselves tell you much of anything. What really helps is to think about how do the scores relate to what else you know about the person.
Stephen Murdoch, how do you respond?
Yeah, I think Amy makes some good points, and I would actually agree with her. I'm pleased to learn that she uses achievement tests and tests of cognitive processing and not just IQ tests. I'm speaking narrowly about IQ tests, and they have not changed. They are the same now as they were 80 years ago. But, of course, these tests are used as a global single number. I mean, it's not just educational assessment. They're used for a definition of mental retardation. And the U.S. Supreme Court has decided that if you're mentally retarded, which is defined usually by under 70 IQ, that you cannot be executed if you've murdered somebody. And so, it does matter, this single global number. If you're under 60, you will be on, you'll be in prison for the rest of your life. If you get over 70, you'll be executed.
But Amy's saying there's an upside here too, that as an educational assessor, she can use this to get kids on the right track in the right place.
I don't think that's true for the IQ test. I think it is more, and I'm happy to hear that Amy, and I know that other professionals use these tests of cognitive processing and achievement tests, and I'm sure that they do more than that. But the global IQ number, let's say you've got a kid who's got a 120 IQ, and the average is 100, so that's a pretty high IQ, but they're not reading or doing math well, that IQ score alone doesn't tell you anything. It's not that useful. And in fact, the subtests, these 13 or 14 subtests in the usual IQ test, they also don't tell you anything. Even the psychologists sometimes think that they do.
I'd like to go back to Amy, but we've lost here. Remind us, if you could, Stephen, of the sort of categories of IQ number. I mean, what is considered
what here? I know that 100 is supposed to be the middle of the human field?
Yeah, average? Exactly. I mean, first of all, there are just a bunch of IQ tests out there, but there's a dominant one that was started by a guy named David Wechsler in the late 1930s, and it's the sort of gold standard today. And for adults, that ranges from about a 45 at the lowest up to a 155, and then 100 would be average.
We hear about people in Mensa, and these are the genius organizations with IQs higher than that, 200 and up.
Yeah, sure, exactly. But that would be, they would have to do different tests. There are people who complain that the Wechsler test can't really get into who the brilliant people are because there are people, you know, like Einstein, whose IQ must have been 203 or whatever it was, and they have created other smaller, lesser-known tests that can go off that Wechsler scale.
Mm. Let's take a call from Plattsburgh, New York. Whitney, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd just like to point out that IQ is no indicator of success. I've known a lot of people who have scored very high, a couple of geniuses, and a lot of them just can't cope in the real world. I think there's a misperception out there that high IQ means high success.
And yet, surely in some fields, you'll find concentrations of people that are very intelligent, Whitney.
True, but I've seen IQ test fail several times. My brother is mentally retarded, and he scored like a 17 because he refused to cooperate with the person who was giving the test.
That would put him in a tough category in many dimensions. Stephen, how about it? The correlation between an IQ number and an individual's success in life.
Yeah, of course. Well, first of all, it's interesting. The psychologist's response to that is that they work on average, which doesn't help the individual very much. I mean, what do we care about on average? That goes, again, to their sort of institutional bias.
But it does point to likelihood, which we do tend to care about.
Exactly, Tom. Yeah, it's a statistical likelihood, and Whitney's absolutely correct. The fact is, there are very slight correlations, statistical correlations, with socioeconomic status. So if you score a 130 on your IQ test, it's more likely that you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer, and you're going to make more money than the average person and be materially better off.
130 plus, that would put you in the top 2% or so.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's right. But, of course, if you do well on tests, you're likely to do well in the SATs and go to a better college, and so it's not quite clear what all of that means. But, you know, there are slight correlations with success in life, but they're nothing worth worrying about, and they're not that grand.
You going all the way back to Galton, Francis Galton, the cousin of Charles Darwin, you quote him writing that a person must inherit, interestingly, capacity, zeal, and vigor. For unless these three, or at the very least two of them, are combined, he cannot hope to make a figure in the world.
There's
the inherit side of that, and I'm curious what we've learned about what's inherited when it comes to IQ, but also these three, capacity, zeal, and vigor, does that just sound hopelessly outdated? If those are still sort of relevant words here, what portion of that trio does IQ capture?
Yeah, oh, God, just great questions, Tom. First of all, the words have, of course, changed. It's one of the interesting things about IQ tests. And back to those seven fellows in rural New Jersey during World War I, there was really a sea change that happened culturally in America. Once IQ tests gained prominence, we started talking more about intelligence and not capacity, zeal, and vigor, and talent, and these other words. The word intelligence supplanted those. And the idea of intelligence became far more important. We talk about intelligence far more now than we used to. And in terms of your question about inheritance, that's also a great question. Somebody like Francis Galton and people for the past 100-plus years would have said that these mental characteristics were 100% inherited and they were genetic. And that idea waxes and wanes, as are the fads within academia. And in the 1960s and 70s, during sort of unrest and political movements, it went way the other way, where environment, people said, mattered far more. The pendulum is beginning to swing back to Francis Galton, where people today, through statistical studies, are saying things like 80% of intelligence comes from genetics, or 60%.
So, in other words, a substantial portion. Let's get a call from Bellevue, Ohio. Joel, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I'd just like to say that I was in the Navy, and I took advanced electronic courses and stuff. And you had to take the ASVAB to get in, you know, those courses and stuff. And
is that an IQ test, Joel, the test you mentioned? Or something like that?
Well, I would think it probably is. It's pretty much like the SAT kind of thing.
Okay,
But anyway, I just think that the military at least saves a lot of money by having people take these classes, and then they can, I mean, not classes, but the test, because if all the classes that I was in, it seems like the people were, their aptitude was, you know, where they could be able to pass the courses and stuff like that, and the Navy's not wasting money.
So it's efficient to sort out who's likely to succeed in those advanced electronics courses,
yeah,
let's say.
One place where I think it was bad, this is like a different test thing my wife had, but she had like this personality thing where they'd set this pie chart on their desk, and it would be like red, yellow, different things. I don't know what you're talking about, but that thing was kind of, I didn't like that, because you walk in somebody's office and you already had a preconceived notion of, you know, there were a lot of reds, so that meant one thing or another, and I think those kind of tests are bad, but
But in the military, it looked like it worked for you, Joel, and or for the Navy. Thanks for that. Stephen, what about it? The SAT-style tests? Are they related to IQ tests? Is it the same thing, different?
Yeah, they're absolutely related. I mean, they're directly descended from them. Those fellows who came out of the World War I testing program in the 1920s fanned out to various areas of the country and in different sectors, and the SAT was based on half of the U.S. military test from World War One, and it's changed, but it hasn't changed that much. It's essentially this what's called the verbal part of IQ tests. You know, that sort of common knowledge and vocabulary, mathematics, your ability to write, things that you would learn in school. That would be the verbal section of an IQ test.
So Joel sees an organizational advantage, certainly in the Navy's training. Let's go to Tampa, Florida, and Anne. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you see, Anne? What do you know?
Well, I was just, you know, struck by the topic today because I think that probably an IQ test has been the greatest impact on what the person I ended up becoming professionally.
How? Why?
Well, I was in fourth grade, and my parents had just moved me from a very tony private school where I was wildly successful to a public school where my grades began to sink and sink and sink. So, obviously, they were a little panicked, so the school took me down to the basement where the cafeteria was and administered what I later found out was my IQ test.
Okay.
And the school then told my parents, oh, she must be bored. She's brilliant. And what strikes me ever since then is this notion that, you know, had I just, they not given me the test, I would have just struggled on, and I don't think I would have succeeded because I was pretty miserable and not doing well in the school. My grades were bad. I probably wouldn't have gone on to school. But because of this, my parents decided, oh, she's smart. We have to push her really hard. And I ended up becoming, I'm a college professor with a PhD. So
Right. So that little test in the basement really helped you. Stephen Murdoch here. Anne says, you know, IQ testing saved my life.
Yeah. Well, Anne, I'm happy. That's great. I'm glad they did. Really, I think what Anne is talking about is she scored well on the test. She gained confidence. The reverse, of course, happened to many, many people and probably many, many more people. I think what we're not worried about here so much is our false positive. People who score really high on the exam and, you know, maybe they're not smart in other areas of their life or not as smart in the way we all talk about them. You know, people who do well on these tests, they probably are smart in some way and good for them. What we should really worry about more are the false negatives. I mean, think about the kid who could have taken calculus and would have enjoyed it and gone on to college. But, you know, at the age of 9, he took an IQ test and got a 98 on it, and he wasn't put in those classes.
But how common is it to get a false negative, a score that indicates intelligence?
Well, you know, that's an unknowable because who knows where that kid would have gone later in life. Maybe he would have been a college professor as well.
No, but I mean about the score itself. I mean, are IQ tests that unreliable? Is it common for a quite intelligent child to come out with a score that says he's very average or less than average?
Well, it's an interesting question. It depends what you mean by reliability. They become reliable in the sense that you score consistently on an IQ test after about the age of 16. Before that, the tests vary quite a bit, especially at an early age. And it's just like Anne's story. We take these things outside of the employment context early in life when our IQ scores fluctuate a great deal. I mean, how you score at the age of 3 does not predict at all how you're going to be even in sixth grade or in junior high. So, you know, there are false scores all of the time.
Stephen Murdoch, you write here and remind us in your book, as you say, IQ tests have often been used for the vilest purposes, no matter that many of their originators had lofty social goals in mind. What are you citing there? Where do you see IQ testing as having most seriously gone off the rails?
Well, this is a great question. We haven't really got to this stuff. We started with the Francis Galton idea that we want to get to people's innate core. And if you really believe, which people have for the past 100 or so years, that you're testing this singular innate ability, then really horrible consequences in the practical world can result. And there are very surprising things about the history of IQ tests that people don't know about. Here in the U.S., we sexually sterilized coercively more than 60,000 people in the 20th century based on low IQ test scores. And people in Western Europe and Central Europe did that as well. Of course, the best example of that was the Nazis during World War II. And it all goes back to this sort of Francis Galton idea that we can test an innate ability. The Nazis ended up sexually sterilizing more than 200,000 people.
And in the U.S., in what decade were we giving people IQ tests and then sterilizing them if they were considered too subnormal?
Well, that, again, is an interesting question. Its heyday was pre-World War II. Of course, the Nazis gave eugenics a bad name. To say the least. So those practices tapered off. So it was mainly the first half of the 20th century. And we used them to cure social ills. That's why these tests have a far broader impact than it first seems. So people in the 19-teens in America were worried about young unmarried women getting pregnant, and they linked moral agency, you know, these young women's morality, mm-hmm. with intelligence. So when they would test them with an IQ test and say, well, she's so dumb, she's going to go and get pregnant, let's just sterilize her. But surprisingly, those ideas, they actually still happened in the late 1970s and early 80s. It happened in the state of Virginia, not in that context, but other ones, but just not as much as happened in the first half of the 20th century.
60,000 people, though, that's a lot of sterilizations. Was it all over the place or just in a few states?
It was all over the place, and it was legal, I think, in more than half of the states. So it was certainly happening a lot in those states. California, where I'm calling from today, mm-hmm. Happened a lot. We were at the forefront. We sterilized 22,000 people. The state of Virginia sterilized about 8,000. But even in states like Pennsylvania, where it was illegal to do so, doctors did it, and they were essentially eugenicists and worried about the gene pool, and they wanted to make sure these tainted genes weren't passed on.
That's a lot of people. When was the last sterilization based on an IQ test done?
Well, that's a good question. It's not quite clear when the last one on IQ tests was done, but like I said, they did happen in the 1970s in Virginia. I'm not sure that they actually applied an IQ test and did it, but I would say it was mid-century that they stopped doing that.
Mm. Let's take a call from Haiti, no less, Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Benjamin is calling. Benjamin, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. I really love your show. I listen to your show every day on the web.
Fantastic. Who knew? Great to have you, Benjamin. What do you think?
In the 70s and in the 60s, they used to use IQ to justify black people ignorance, because black people always score below white folks. So my question is, why should black people believe in IQ as something reliable?
Stephen Murdoch, what's the history? And straight to Benjamin's question, why believe it, given the history?
Oh, my goodness. Benjamin, what a question. Yeah, this is really the third rail of the subject, and one that makes me a little nervous. But, you know, there's a terrible history of black-white relations and IQ testing. Starting with Francis Galton, he made assumptions about Africans that were completely baseless and untrue. And Benjamin's absolutely right. They still talk today, psychologists do, about black-white differences. One of the facts of the past 100 years is that there's been an average difference between white American scores and African American scores. And on average, whites score 15 points higher than blacks. And what you make of that, of course, is what all the fighting is about. You either think that the tests are biased against African-Americans, or you think that there are environmental differences that create these differences in the tests, or you think that there are genetic differences, of course, which I don't.
So where does this come down? I mean, this is a consequential question, and Benjamin, calling from Haiti, feels like the whole thing is a kind of scam to disadvantage him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends on context. I don't know if it's a scam. You know, it's a good question. The basic idea here is that IQ tests do not measure intelligence. So the fact that there is a difference between black and white scores, these are tests of knowledge and some sort of abstract problem-solving ability. And if you believe the test score, this native ability, then it takes you down these very dangerous alleys where you're going to draw these dangerous conclusions. I mean, look what the Nazis ended up doing. They ended up murdering people who scored low in IQ tests. And I've interviewed psychologists for this who say because of this black-white IQ difference, we have problems with our democracy. It's just not true. These are essentially lies.
But if it doesn't measure intelligence, this IQ, intelligence quotient, what does it measure?
It measures knowledge. What's an armadillo, for instance? Who wrote Hamlet? Your vocabulary and math, and some sort of hard-to-know-what-it-is abstract problem-solving ability when it comes to the nonverbal side of IQ tests. It doesn't test intelligence. In large part, when you look at the history, you figure that out. These guys in rural New Jersey during World War I cobbled together the tests from various practical circumstances. They didn't have an idea of how the brain worked. They didn't have an intelligence theory, or they didn't understand genetics. These things are a result of historical circumstance.
Stephen Murdoch, stand by if you'd be good enough. I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining us from the Poconos in Pennsylvania is Angela Lee Duckworth, professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. She administers IQ tests as part of her research on achievement in children and adults. Angela Lee Duckworth, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
So Stephen Murdoch has dived in as a journalist and brought us some really interesting history about IQ testing. You're trained in it professionally. What do you think of the utility today of IQ testing? You use it. Do you have doubts about it? Is it essential? How do you see IQ testing?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I would consider myself primarily a non-IQ researcher. So, you know, if you look at my papers, you know, they're almost entirely about things other than IQ that predict achievement. What is absolutely true is that for the last 100 years, there's been such a preoccupation with IQ that you kind of can't study achievement without at least saying, look, I tested for IQ, and here is the other stuff. I mean, you almost can't legitimately say that you're going to study something like self-discipline or perseverance or ambition without at least addressing IQ. So dominant has IQ become the last 100 years in the academic literature.
So when you say other stuff, you mean exactly that kind of thing, discipline, perseverance, motivation,
yeah,
that sort of thing.
I mean, things that would fall, I think, into the categories of personality and motivation.
So when you look, let's say, at a child, and you're looking to assess their capacity, I guess, what portion of it does an IQ number represent to you? Or does the IQ number itself encompass perseverance, motivation, and all that? Does a child have to have perseverance and discipline and motivation in order to score well on an IQ test?
Well, let me address that in two parts. Mm-hmm. And the first part, by the way, I am calling from the Poconos, so I apologize.
No problem. Vacation land USA.
In the background. But what I would say is that the first answer to that question is that, you know, how much of success, for example, in school or in professional life does IQ account for? And the most generous estimates will say that, you know, about 50%, right? So about 50% of the differences between people's achievement can be attributed to IQ at the outside figure, and then there are figures that are lower than that. Just that fact alone suggests to me that the glass is at least half empty. In other words, that you're going to have to look beyond IQ to understand why people succeed at different levels. And the chief candidates for that are not terribly surprising. We found in our work that self-discipline is a fantastic predictor of children's grades. In fact, in our studies, we find it to be a better predictor of their report card grades than their IQ scores. Perseverance is another predictor, and ambition. So that's one answer to your question, which is that when I talk about everything else in terms of motivation and personality, mm-hmm. these things are accounting for a substantive amount of the unexplained variance in achievement. The second part of my response would be about IQ testing in general. I tested a group of ninth graders recently in a standard IQ test, and they did terribly. I mean, they did something like 20 points below average on this IQ test. And it just struck me. I mean, I knew these ninth graders, and I thought, well, these kids are not 20 points below average. Mm. You know, what happened? And it wasn't all that mysterious. I mean, the kids were taking this test. It was very effortful. It was, you know, problems they had never seen before. It was probably not very fun for them. And a lot of them just sort of, you know, put their pencil down about 5 minutes into it and just, you know, stopped. So what I did was I went back to that same group of kids and I gave them a one-on-one IQ test. In a one-on-one situation, it's very hard to just sort of put your head down and stop because yeah. you've got a psychologist there kind of right. encouraging you on.
Right.
And, you know, lo and behold, their test scores went up, you know, about 17 points. So they had more or less closed the gap between, you know, the previous scores and what we would call average. And that, to me, suggests that at least with some populations, you know, you've got to be really careful about interpreting IQ test scores as representing their maximal performance. You know, kids can, you know, choose not to perform well on a test for stomach ache reasons, test anxiety reasons, and sometimes they just don't see the point of it all. So so that would be my major caveat in terms of, you know, applying testing so broadly in society and kind of just assuming that everybody's doing their very best on them.
Stephen Murdoch, what does that leave you thinking about the context for test taking when numbers can have such a big impact on how children are seen or see themselves even?
Yeah, I think Dr. Duckworth is absolutely right. You know, these tests, the standardized tests that came out of IQ tests and IQ tests are called objective tests. And I think the professor's points are essentially that they might be objective to grade. I mean, you can machine grade SAT tests, but they're certainly not objective to write, and they're definitely subjective to take. And confidence is going to matter, how much you like taking tests, your curiosity, your desire to stick to something, all these other factors that are subjective to the test taker that are being tested indirectly by IQ tests and yet are not talked about when we talk about IQ test results.
Let's take a call from New York City. Steve, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I am an organizational psychology consultant. So I don't do IQ testing per se,
okay.
but I'm fairly familiar with some of the research in this area. And I want to comment, IQ tests have changed tremendously over the last 80 years. For one thing, we renorm them constantly. As I think your caller earlier, Amy, said, it's not one number. It's a set of numbers, a set of subscores that allows fairly detailed factor analysis. So it's not trying to boil someone down to a single number that says X, Y, or Z.
So when Stephen Murdoch says we haven't changed these tests in 80 years, it sounds like that's rubbing you the wrong way. You think they have.
I think they've changed quite a bit. I think intelligence is certainly a nebulous concept and one that, you know, we're still working on trying to understand what it is. But today's tests represent a much greater level of research and study and attempt to understand this and accurately measure it.
Let us pick it up, Stephen. Thank you for that. Dr. Duckworth, what do you say? The same as they ever were or refined today?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's evidence for both sides of this issue. I mean, it is true that if you pick up, you know, say the Wechsler intelligence test, you know, the most widely used test for both children and adults today, and you look at the items and you say, well, let me compare how these items look to, you know, how they were in, say, the 1940s or the 1930s, if I go back to the Stanford-Binet test.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely true that you find striking commonalities. I mean, some of the formats are the same, and some of the very questions may be the same. So that is true. On the other hand, your most recent caller raises a good point, which is that, you know, there have been, intelligence testers, psychologists who specialize in intelligence, who have been studying the field. It's not that they haven't thought hard about what these tests mean and how they could be improved for the last, you know, several decades. So there are some advances on the, you know, he alluded to something called factor analysis, and that's basically a fancy statistical technique to see, you know, how test items or, in fact, subtests correlate with each other.
Mm.
And, you know, there have been advances in kind of trying tweaking, making sure the tests correlate more with each other, making sure that the items hang together more. If you have a spurious item that doesn't seem to be testing, you know, picking up differences between people, they know how to throw them out now. So I would say yes and no. You know, tests have progressed in many ways, and they're more refined. But in other dramatic ways, they're very much the same.
Let me take a call from Greensboro, North Carolina. Paulette, you're on the air.
Hello. We were parents of kids in elementary school in the 80s and in the 90s.
Yeah.
And we were appalled by the program called GAT, the Gifted and Talented Program.
Why?
And they're in elementary school, starting in the first grade. They test children, and these children are put in a separate category. They take separate classes. Some they take with the other children. But they get to go on trips, and they right away, they have, there's something special about them. which is very damaging to children who are not selected for the program. And my husband and I tried to talk to the teachers and do something about that, but to no avail. They just said have our kids tested, which we wouldn't allow.
So you didn't want your children tested, so then they couldn't be in the gifted...
Right. As I don't think testing children, they have something special about them, and you know, starting in elementary school, that's ridiculous. They don't, you know, they should all be on equal footing, I believe, in public schools. And we felt that was very damaging.
Paulette, that's a really interesting story. Stephen Murdoch, how do you respond? Paulette didn't want her children tested and then felt that they were cut out of, you know, an advantaged group. On the other hand, those kind of programs are active all over the country, and I'm sure parents whose children get into them feel lucky and probably happy about it.
Yeah, I think the programs themselves can be great. I mean, they're stimulating for the kids, and these kids can achieve at those levels. The problem is that they're high-stakes exams, and the exams aren't very good. And so it's sort of one day, one test decides if you go into these special programs and if you get to take these great trips to the zoo or the symphony or whatever it is, and the rest of the kids are left out, in a sense, out in the cold. And it goes back to the idea of worrying about false negatives. You don't know that those kids who weren't in the classes couldn't perform at that level, and it's a shame for them. They're being cut out.
Dr. Duckworth, Paulette wasn't happy about what happened with her kids, but as a society, should we? Do we need to be doing that kind of testing at that early age in order to, you know, respond to the capacity of kids who are high-charged?
Yeah, my view on this, and I speak as a former high school teacher as well and a parent of a 4- and 5-year-old, and by the way, myself, someone who, you know, at the age of 10 took an IQ test, and I guess it was a bad day because I was suddenly not in the gifted program, and the next year I guess it was a good day because I was suddenly back in the gifted program. So I'm certainly sensitive
right.
to, you know, these, you know, the unreliability. And, you know, my view on this is that, you know, if you have kids who want to take calculus, who, you know, show that they can do the work, who can keep up with the homework assignments and pay attention in class, then they should take calculus. And if you have kids who, you know, if you think about in elementary school the kind of things that gifted and talented programs the sort of things that they offer, you know, they're often special classes. You know, maybe there'll be a class on theology or on how the stock market works or statistics. You know, my feeling is that if you have children who, for whatever reason, natural ability, motivation, innate curiosity, you know, step up to the plate and say, yeah, I want to do that extra thing, then they should be allowed. And we should, you know, not sort of obsess about whether on one day they had a certain number above a threshold or not. And I think that would just probably make everyone happy because, you know, if the intelligence tests are right, then, you know, those smart kids should, you know, step up to the plate.
Stephen Murdoch, looking at history, looking at where we are today, where do you think we're headed in terms of assessing intelligence and categorizing and slotting our fellow citizens, each other? Are we going to be doing more and more of this as genetics and many other kinds of testing give us more insight? Or does this look like a kind of imponderable, ultimately, you know, hard to really define the full intelligence of a person?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, first of all, I'd have to say that I'm not anti-test. I mean, we live in a complicated, industrialized world, and institutions have to test people and sort them. But I am happy to say, in terms of the direction we're going, since the early 1980s, there's been this blossoming within psychology of looking at intelligence more broadly. And one of the strains that's happening there that I think is probably going to catch on and will catch on more are tests of cognitive processing. They'll test people's ability to pay attention and to deal with stimuli as it comes into them simultaneously and sequentially. And a lot of that is based on the revolution that's happened in the cognitive sciences over the past 50 or 60 years. It is true, to go back to Steve's earlier point, that the IQ tests, the narrow original IQ tests, have not changed. There are 14 subtests in the Wechsler exams, and 11 of them are pre-World War I technology. The good thing about cognitive processing exams is that they've actually looked at this field of cognitive sciences and said, hey, we know a lot more about how the brain works today. Let's have a theory-based way of creating exams and try to test those brain functions. And so I think that's where we're headed.
Well, a whole new world coming up there, and yet part of a story that began long ago, and it's been great to get some insight into it today. I want to thank each of you. Angela Lee Duckworth at the University of Pennsylvania, professor of psychology there. Dr. Duckworth, wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us from the Poconos today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Stephen Murdoch, thanks for all your research. Thanks for bringing us the big story. Really interesting. Thanks for joining us today.
Tom, that was such fun. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Murdoch, author of IQ, A Smart History of a Failed Idea. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.